Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we're focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, today my guest is Aaron Marshall. Aaron served as a military police officer in Iraq and has written a book called Bakuba, Bones and Blood, which is about his experiences over there. The book is written in a way that helps the reader better understand the root causes of the traumas that are facing the modern day soldiers. I have him on the show today to talk a little bit about his book and some of the things that he's up to. So welcome to the show, Aaron. I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say I butchered the title of the book. I didn't. Okay, that's surprising, actually.
You know, I'm actually changing the name of it when it's released next year. It's going to be called Orchard of Bones.
Okay,
awesome. Because so many people have trouble with that, myself included, and I live there. I'm changing the name to Orchard of Bones.
Okay. So anyways, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and what you are up to.
Sure. I originally was in the Army National Guard in Plymouth, New Hampshire. And right after basic for that and AIT, they retrained me as an MP and sent me to the front lines. So that was quite the experience. And then after that, I spent 10 years as a musician touring New England. And then I just kind of gave it up because about 7 years ago, I quit drinking. So, and I hadn't been able to play music without alcohol. So, but now I am. Now I'm playing without alcohol. I play with my oldest daughter is better than I am. Teaches me every time we meet. She's like, Dad, you know what you're doing? And I say, no. And she's like, well, then she gives the musical term for it, you know?
Okay.
So that's pretty cool. Now I'm a stay-at-home dad too. That's my biggest position right now, and I love it. I feel like I'm in heaven. Like, you know, my kids are happy, I'm happy. It's weird for me to be happy, so I'm slowly learning to enjoy it.
That's awesome, and I'm glad that you found that that thing that brings you happiness and a sense of purpose and meaning in your life too.
Because I know that absolutely.
That's something that a lot of times people getting out of the military will struggle with, is finding a sense of purpose or something that gives them a reason to get out of bed in the morning, you know?
Yeah. And what something that gives me purpose now is I also volunteer for a veterans organization called Operation Reboot Outdoors. Yes. They take veterans, active duty members out free fishing and hunting. It's pretty amazing. So I'm proud to be a part of that organization.
Yeah, we'll have to talk a little bit more about that too. But first, I want to get into a little bit more of your background and your story. You served in Iraq in Bakuba. I'm assuming I'm pronouncing that correctly.
Well, I butcher it like this. I call it Bakuba.
Okay, Bakuba. Okay.
Yep.
All right. Well, that works for me. So, anyways. Regardless of what it's called, was in Iraq, and it's a city like kind of northeast of Baghdad. Is that correct?
50 kilometers northeast, on the Diyala River.
Yeah. Okay, and so tell us a little bit about your time there in Iraq and what your experience was like over there and what you did over there.
Well, first, can I just read one thing here? I think it would kind of set it up. Oh, I don't have it with me. Never mind.
Okay.
I grabbed the wrong edition of my book, and I had some.
Okay, no problem.
I mean, Bakuba was hell. There's no way to say it other than that. There was a VBIED that went off every day in that city. I think there might've been one day in a year where one didn't go off. And it was, I don't know, it was quite the experience because I was originally in New Hampshire Army National Guard. And so I was trained on the big guns, you know, and then they took my whole unit and retrained us as MPs and were like, just let us loose. And man, I mean, I couldn't have picked a shorter straw for where I ended up.
Right. So in the, what was your original MOS when you were in the guard?
13B.
Okay. So I was just curious, like what that transition was, like what the background is of that transition and how that came about.
We have a lot of people in our unit that were cops and correctional officers. So that was one of the reasons why they trained us as MPs. Plus they needed it. They didn't need gun bunnies, you know?
Yeah.
So we got trained in a rather short period of time, maybe 5 weeks got for training for that. Just the basics, you know, that whole experience, the beginning of the journey. I mean, like, I almost forget about it because it was like the last peaceful moments of my former life, you know?
Yeah.
But I'm happy where I'm at today. So.
No, that is a good thing. I know a few MPs who were in Iraq, probably I would imagine around the same time frame as you were, and they said that their experience was kind of bordering on an infantry deployment with the types of patrols that they were on and the things that they were asked to do.
We were kicking doors in and stuff. Yeah. So yeah.
Yeah. So it's probably not too far off from you know, the other guys that I've spoken to who've been over there, and yeah, they were kicking doors in, tossing grenades in the rooms, and you know, things like that to, you know, clear the houses and everything. Cool. Like you said, it is hell. You know, it's not a, you know, it's not a glorious experience or anything.
No, I think sucks. War at its base is nothing less than the death of humanity.
Yeah, no, exactly. I mean, that's when all the other forms of negotiations and stuff have kind of just broken down, where, you know, communication, like let's try to talk us through these problems and stuff. And we've just kind of broken down and we gotten to the point where no one is really able to do anything other than just kill each other. You know?
Yeah, it's not good.
So let's switch gears just a little bit here and talk a little bit about your book. I know it's about your time over there, but it has other messages in the book as well, as far as, you know, talking about the traumas and things like that. So let's talk a little bit about the book, like what prompted you to write it and what it's all about and go from there.
Okay. Well, the idea started when I was 18. I fell in love with Hunter S. Thompson and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. I love that book. I loved how it was written, but not the book by Hunter, the screenplay by Tony Grassoni. I like that writing better. So that's where I got the idea from for recording, because I have hours and hours of recordings from the front lines. My wife sent me this little recorder so I could hear my daughter's heartbeat. And after I heard it, I used the rest of the tapes to record stuff. So I have hours and hours of tapes of me just bullshitting with friends and stuff over there. Iraqis, I interviewed Iraqis over there too.
Okay.
So, and I had a lot of close Iraqi friends. There's actually a chapter in my book dedicated to all my Iraqi friends.
Cool. Awesome. Yeah. So with that recorder, you would just go around basically and just, you know, just keep it rolling basically during
interactions
with people.
If I didn't catch anything, I would just start over, you know. And I actually took out one of my magazines and I put it in there. Probably not supposed to do that, but you know.
Well, you know, they give you enough pockets on your uniform that you could probably shove it in, you know, one of the cargo pockets or
in
a back pocket. You know, you can find places for magazines. I know when we went out on patrol, sometimes we get a little creative with where we were putting magazines or, you know, whatever else that we needed to carry. We'd find places for it. You always get overloaded.
Yeah, that's part of the game, right? Exactly. But then the book idea basically started when I was a senior in high school in Winthrop, and something I always wanted to do was write a book like that. So, you know, I made some bad decisions and did a lot of drugs along the way, but I'm sober now. I'll be 7 years clean this August 1st.
Okay.
And I mean, I think part of the reason why I struggled for so long is I was writing this book, because it's really hard to go back to some of those moments and you know, go over them. Like, there was a car bomb that went off that killed 72 people. And I was one of the first people there on scene, but I don't remember anything from that day.
Oh, wow.
It's like my memory just clicks off, which is probably a good thing.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. Considering how many people were killed in that, you know, I'm sure that it was quite the gruesome experience to witness. And, you know, our brain sometimes will just shut off
those
experiences, so you don't have to relive them over and over.
Yeah. In this book, I just want to help as many people as I can. And I already have people messaging me and saying how they're just blown away by how candid I am. And I don't leave anything out, even the bad stuff that I did, the stuff that isn't part of my ideal story, I still leave it in there because that's how people get through their hard times, is knowing that somebody else has been through it. So,
right. Yeah. And that's honestly the reason why I do this podcast, is to talk to people like you and other veterans who've had a hard time with something, whether it's substance abuse or, some mental health issues, or they struggled with something and they've come out on the other side of that struggle, a better person. They're, a changed person. Obviously you're not the same person that you were before you joined the Army, and you've changed over the years, but we all change in one way or another. And
exactly.
And so, like, change is good, change is okay, but it's, how you change. You want to make sure it's a positive change. You don't want to end up going down some rabbit hole of self-destructive behaviors,
exactly,
that end up hurting you more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you said a lot of people have reached out saying, that it was great for you to be so candid and, open about your experiences. What makes you telling your story, such an important thing to do? Why do you think it will help other people, I guess?
Well, because I've had a book help me in the same way. And that's when it really drove the point home. I have a friend who I went to high school with. She wrote a book called After the Eclipse.
Okay.
It's about her mother's murder when she was 12 years old. She was there, and she writes about it, and she writes beautifully about it, about the memory of her mother and all these little moments. And I never thought I'd finish this thing, but I read that book and it inspired me so much. And I finished this, and I mean, I've been working on it for 15 years, and then I read her book and I'm done like the next month. So It was just, she's so inspiring that if she can do it, I can do it. So yeah, I'm trying to just help people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think sometimes you don't even realize how one story, your story, could impact other people, like your friend here. Obviously that's a terrible experience to have to go through, losing a family member that way. But in writing it, it also helps other people. And, yourself included. And then by that person writing that book, you were able to finish your book, and now it's helping other people too. So it almost has like an exponential effect where it's, ballooning out and reaching other people, which is pretty awesome.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It takes a life of its own, really, when you put it out in the world there. So mine's, I have a lot of swear words in it. This is really tried to write I'm having a candid conversation with a friend. So these aren't detailed technical things that I'm talking about. I really break it down so that if anybody was in my position, they're going to know what it was like. Cause I say what I was feeling, what I was thinking. Like, there was one time where I was trying to keep Iraqis back from, we had a helicopter crash near us, trying to keep them back. This was like my third day there. And I was pointing my machine gun, M16. And nobody was really listening. So I yelled, "Get the F back." And that made him go back. But I remember thinking at the time, like, oh my God, I wish we could, go have some tea and talk about the weather. This is not what I want to be doing with my life,
Right, right. Yeah, I remember, situations like that too, where there's a language barrier. And so I was in Afghanistan, not Iraq, but there's a few universal truths in terms of like language that people will understand. One time I was standing on the side of a road, and there was a car driving pretty quickly towards our area, and I kind of motioned with my hand like, slow down, and all of a sudden they just slammed on the brakes. And I'm thinking, wow, that really worked. Me just kind of motioning. I just expected them to kind of maybe slow down a little bit or whatever. Yeah. and but they slammed on the brakes and came to a dead stop. Well, I turned around and one of the other guys that I was with, he was pointing his pistol right at him. And so that's what got them to stop. Me moving my hand like that, they would have completely ignored that.
But you're like, that works so well.
I was like, wow, that was like a magical thing. Like, how did I get them to stop back? No, it was just the pistol being shoved in their face, basically, to get back at them to stop. But
I have a story like that from my book where I talk about, I pulled a pistol out on, I was at the front gate of the police station and all these Iraqis were lining up every day to conduct their business. It was just me and one other guy up there, and there was over 100 people lined up, and they kept getting closer and bunching up, and I just kind of sort of freaked out, grabbed my gun and pointed it at the first Iraqi in front of me, and everyone calmed down. I didn't have to say anything. Everyone just calmed down and chilled, but I wish I could have handled that better, you know, but that's just how I handled that moment, you know?
Well, one of the things that we learned just through the experience of being over there is that a lot of times the Afghans that we were dealing with, the last interactions with like foreign troops that they had were Russians back when the Russians were, you know, invaded the country. And the only thing that they really took seriously was threats of violence. Like they, you know, if you just like said, hey, can you please do this? They were like, you know, maybe, you know, who knows, you know, we don't necessarily
different culture with that. They do everything on their own time, which is tomorrow. Always tomorrow.
Well, a lot of times, even our interpreters, not to fault them, because they were, for the most part, they were really great. But a lot of times they would use the inshallah, you know, God willing, phrase with us. So we'd ask them to do something and they'd say, inshallah, you know, like God willing, it'll get done. And if it's not God's will, it won't get done. But it's like, no, I'm asking you to go do this thing now. Like
that's the difference of the culture. I remember that so vividly. Like my superiors would bitch to me about the fact that nobody did anything. That would say, oh, tomorrow, God willing, we'll get it done. Yeah. And it was like, well, we're trying to set up a government here. We got to just do it today, you know?
Yeah.
So it was hard to balance that out.
And some of it's like security things, like we need these people to like move away for security purposes. It's like, well, inshallah, you know, they'll move. Well, no, they're moving. It's either that or we're going to start shooting.
Yeah,
it's like, so get them out of here.
And we had our orders were, if we were driving, you know, doing missions on the road, we could put a round in somebody's trunk if they didn't get out of our way. Yeah. So
yeah, we probably had a little more tight rules of engagement when we were over in Afghanistan.
I was 0405.
Yeah, this was 2010, so this was a few years later. But we weren't able to do that stuff unless it was like they're driving right at you and that type of thing, you know, and it became like a threat. But if they were just driving too slow, you know, that was not exactly the best way to do it. A lot of times though they would drive with their windows open, you know, because their cars didn't have air conditioning or whatever, and we'd throw like water bottles into their car. Like from the gunner's turret, we just like chuck them in, and then they'd like bounce all over the inside of the car and they freak out and swerve off the road.
Oh man.
So
I forgot what I was going to say.
But, but yeah, I mean, it really is a different culture over there. You know, and I think it, you know, it's kind of like a little sidetrack a little bit, but I think it's important for people who haven't been over there to understand that, you know, when you go over to another country like Iraq or Afghanistan, you're not dealing with people with the same mindset as other Americans.
Exactly.
You know, a lot of times, you know, here in America, even within America, we have different mindsets on different things. There's different political views, and there's, you know, different cultures and, you know, people from different backgrounds and stuff like that. But over there, it's kind of different because everyone is part of that culture, you know, the Afghan or Iraqi culture, and they're all part of that. And they all have a very similar mindset with a lot of the things that they do. There's this one time where a guy pulled up to we have like a checkpoint, you know, between Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we were stopping some vehicles just to check to see, you know, kind of random checks to see if they're carrying weapons or, you know, anything like that. And we had the guy pop the trunk and he had his dog in the trunk. And Afghanistan, probably just like Iraq, is out of hot as hell over there. And
Yeah.
And the dog was looking rough. Like, he was in rough shape. It was just so hot in the back of that trunk. There's no air conditioning. There's no ventilation or anything like that. So I popped open the top of a water bottle and I sprayed it into the dog's mouth. But the guy was asking for a water for himself. And so I was like, no, I'm giving your dog water before I'm going to give you water, because you're going to treat this thing like crap, you know. But that's just the culture. Like, you know, here in America, people are, you leave a dog in a parking lot when you run into a store, people break your windows to go rescue the dog. But over there, they're not treated the same way, you know.
Yeah, in Iraq, we had a situation where and this happened a lot, where there was people drive, like the man would be driving, and he'd have his dog next to him. He'd be driving a truck and he'd have his wife and kid in the back of a truck in the bed, like so often. And I'm like, what is going on here? You know?
Yeah, it's definitely a different world. It's a different culture.
I think it's mostly, I read a lot of Eastern philosophy recently, and that has really made me understand my time in Iraq, I think, more than anything, because they have like religion as their base in their culture. Like, it's intertwined with everything that they do. Yeah. So that's why it's God willing, you know?
Right. No, exactly. And it's, I mean, we do have that to some extent here, the Western culture. But it's on a different level over there, I think. Like,
big time.
Like, everything that they do is religious based. Mm. And it's, there's not too many people who you would meet that would, not have religion as the center point of their life, or if they didn't, at least they wouldn't admit it, because
exactly.
The culture is, you know?
Yeah.
So as far as like telling your story, you've gone through the process of writing the book. I know you said it was a long process to get there. And what advice would you have for other veterans who are thinking about writing a book? Maybe they're in the process of writing the book. They've jotted down some notes maybe, and they have an idea, but they just haven't really gotten there yet.
Well, I think something that's really important that I should have done is I didn't always check in with myself to see how I was doing before I worked on this. Mm-hmm. 'Cause it's going to trigger you. Even if you don't think it's going to trigger you, it is. So, if you don't believe in PTSD, you don't want to be one of the people like me who finds out the hard way. So you want to be in a good mental space before you even start on something like this. But a big thing is, if you remember a story, write it down, start typing it out, saying it immediately when you think about it, get it on paper, on a computer. And don't worry about what the book's going to look like at the end. Just write down all your stories, and then that's going to kind of come to you afterwards, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's great advice. Because your mind will play tricks on you. You know, if you have a story right now that is happening right now, like, write it down, because a year from now, you're going to remember that story a little bit differently than it actually took place. You know?
Exactly. That's where the tapes come in handy for my book. Right. Because I know exactly what people said, and it's pretty cool. I have conversations with interpreters, and it was one conversation where they were mad at me for using toilets. They said it was healthier to just shit in the hole in the bathroom, and we had a long discussion about this, and stuff like that. It's just like wild that something so simple as like a toilet, they don't use one, and they don't think it's a good idea. I think one of the first toilets ever made was actually near Bakuba, Iraq, a couple thousand years ago. There's evidence of that. So it just, it blows my mind that they lost that technology, you know?
Yeah. And and talk about cultural differences, like that's huge, you know? Like, I remember seeing guys just stopping on the side of the road and taking a dump and then wiping their ass with their hand.
Yeah. And left hand.
Yeah, left hand. They'll never touch your left hand, or grab food or anything like that with the left hand, because that is they don't do anything with the left hand except for wipe their ass basically. But it was like I see this guy just like squatting down and taking a dump, and I was like, this is disgusting.
I've seen that too.
It's common, like it happens all over the place over there. So
yeah, and pulling lookout duty, I'm gonna say once a week I'd see somebody taking a shit on the side of the road.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's like, you know, why wouldn't you use the toilets or, you know, have them available. But, you know, the modern, you know, plumbing that we take for granted, they don't have it the way we have it here. And so
not even close. We didn't even have regular electricity where we were at. So,
yeah. Yeah, exactly. And a lot of places are like that too. They don't have the electricity running to, you know, the villages and the houses and the plumbing with the water. You know, they have to walk, you know, the way you would think, like, you know, early settlers of this country, that they would go and get water. They'd go walk to a lake or a river or something like that, and they'd go collect their water and bring it back to their house. Like, that's pretty much how they have to do it there. They have a trek to do it, you know?
Yeah.
So you briefly mentioned earlier Operation Reboot Outdoors.
I did.
And I'd love to talk to you a little bit about that, unless there's anything else about your book that you wanted to
drop. I could talk about my book for days, but we might as well. I really could. I mean, I probably know every word in it by heart because I've been focusing on it for 15 years or so. But
right.
Operation Reboot Outdoors, I mean, this is an organization. They're saving lives. They take a veterans, active duty military, and LEOs, that's law enforcement officers. They take them out hunting and fishing with a Maine guide for free every day of the year, almost every day of the year. And they have been blowing up. We raised $60,000 in one weekend for ice fishing derby.
Oh, wow.
The year before, we raised like $25,000 in a weekend. And the year before that, I don't think, you know, it was half that for the entire year. So we're really building steam. I help out with their marketing and stuff like that. They were on a show with Mike Rowe. I think it's called Returning the Favor.
Yes.
They got gifted a side by side for the missions. So that was pretty awesome. Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. The guy, the president of the, you know, founder, I went to middle school with him and we never liked each other. All the middle school, high school, we were always fighting because we were both competitive, you know? And now, I mean, he inspires me more than almost anybody, you know.
Funny how that works out.
It's so weird. Like, he wrote in my yearbook, "I'm going to kick the shit out of you." I still have it, too. So.
But, you know, we all grow up and we all, you know, have different experiences and everything. And you know, it turns out you guys have some shared experiences. And
I didn't know he was in the military and he didn't know I was in the military. And cause my senior year, I switched schools to another school to get more exposure. Cause I played basketball.
Okay.
And we just never clicked before, but now it's like, I understand him. I get where he's coming from, you know?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing.
And that's an interesting thing too about veterans. I talk to a lot of veterans that, you know, like you, prior to today, we've never spoken face to face or anything.
Exactly.
You know, and we're over a Zoom call now, you know, recording, but you know, but we're able to just kind of pick up and, you know, shoot the shit, tell stories, you know, talk about deployments and stuff. And it's, we have like a shared experience in terms of, you know, being in the military and being deployed and stuff. And we're able to just have those conversations, you know, fairly easily. And, you know, maybe if we knew each other back in middle school, maybe we wouldn't have been, you know, best friends or anything like that. But now, after, you know, all these years later, we're a little bit older. We have this experience. We're able to have these conversations. I found that to be true with a lot of the veterans that I speak with. It's just really easy to speak with each other about
Even realize it sometimes that you're telling stories about your tour because you're just so comfortable, you know, talking with, like, you. I'm comfortable now talking with you. So,
yeah,
you know, you could ask me anything and I would answer it. No.
No, exactly. And I think that's the point. And I the reason why I bring that up is because there's some people out there who they're struggling with something and, oh, nobody's going to understand me. No one knows what I'm going through.
You're not alone. That's what I say to them. You are not alone. I've been there. Trust me, I've been in a lot of down situations, and life gets good when you start, you know, working on yourself. Don't judge other people. Just judge yourself and only judge from yourself the day before, you know?
Yeah, just try to get that 1% better every day, you know, exactly. Whatever it is. And it seems like that's not a lot. It's not going to move the needle. But after a year, you're gonna see some improvement, you know.
It really does. And
after 2, 3, 4 years, like you're going to be a changed person if you focus on that one thing and just change. Try to change a little bit. Don't try to do any earth shattering, changes in a day or in a week. You know, because it's not going to work. It doesn't stick. That's why your people who make New Year's resolutions, they quit on them by, you know, mid-February. Like they're trying to do too much, bite off too much at once. And it just doesn't work. So take small steps, baby steps. You know, in the military, they do the crawl, walk, run phase. You don't start off running on anything. You crawl. You have to start off that way. It's the same way as a baby. A baby's not going to, you know, jump out of their crib one day and start running around the house. They have to learn how to crawl first. They have to learn how to walk, and then they'll eventually start running around the house and driving you crazy. But you know,
mine don't drive me crazy, believe it or not. They really don't. They're good. I got lucky. They're good kids. They're great.
I say that a little tongue in cheek. My kids are great too. I mean, they have their days, but they're good.
Oh, everyone does. Yeah, for sure.
So anyways, all the stuff that you've been doing, I think is really great. The Operation Reboot Outdoors, your book, talking about the different experiences that you've had and everything. I think it's, from my perspective, I think people like you who write your stories down, tell your stories, they help other people opening up the same way that your friend did who wrote that book that you talked about earlier, and that helped you to be able to tell your story. And I think by you writing your story, it's going to help somebody else to tell their story, and it's going to have a snowball effect where there's just going to be stories that get told.
Exactly.
And I think another thing that we have going in the post 9/11 era, that people from previous generations, maybe the World War One and Two, you know, even earlier, Korea War, they may have had a story to tell, but the barrier to entry to write a book was pretty high back then. Like it was not an easy thing to get done. To find a publisher who's willing to invest in it and publish the book and put it out there. And so there's, I got to imagine, a lot of stories that just went untold because it was just that mindset of, well, my story's not going to get published. Why am I going to put all this effort into writing this book? But nowadays it's so much easier. Amazon has ways of self-publishing. There's tons of self-publishing.
Yeah, I published my own stuff. I have poetry books too that I publish. I do it all myself through the publishing company called Lulu. And basically you do all your own work and you set up everything, the prices and every part of it is in your control. And the best thing I like about Lulu is you don't have to pay in advance for the books. When somebody buys it, then they'll make it.
Perfect. Yeah. So it's a print on demand kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's saved me a lot of money and time.
Right. And so it's a lot lower barrier to entry to get your work out there. And so if you have a story to tell, for the listeners out there, if you have a story to tell, write it down. You don't have to be a great writer. It doesn't have to be the next blockbuster hit, movie that it's going to get turned into or anything like that. But it's a story, and your story is important because it could help other people. It could, make somebody else inspired to write their story, which then goes on and helps somebody else. And
snowball effect. Yeah,
exactly. And also we're not going to be here forever. And somebody is going to want to know what happened in the Iraq and Afghanistan wars. And without these stories being written down to hand on to the next generation, where are we going to have these stories, situated? So I think it's important to do,
It was a quote that I had in my book I was looking for. Basically it's called A Message for You. And it's before the book starts. And basically say, you're not alone. If you think you are, you're not. I've been there, and there is help. You just have to want to accept it.
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of times people, they get turned off by, you know, like the VA, for example. Like,
oh, don't get me started on the VA.
You know, people don't trust the VA. They don't want to deal with the VA. They think that, you know, there's problems with the, and it's fine if that's your mindset or whatever, but there's part of the reason why this podcast, they do a lot of good. But part of the reason why this podcast is even exists is to highlight other organizations that do work with veterans. So the VA is not your only source of help that's out there. There are other organizations, and a lot of them are free of cost. They're nonprofits, and that they're out there, you know, taking people like you were talking about earlier, going hunting and fishing and doing those types of things.
And they're a nonprofit too, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And so those organizations exist to help out, and their whole mission is to help out veterans and mm-hmm. and, you know, people who are just like the people who might be listening to this. So listen to some of the previous episodes that I've had on here and listen to what organizations are out there, and do your own research, because there might be some organizations that are local to your area that will help out veterans, you know, whether it's art therapy or, you know, outdoors, you know, activities or any number of other things. Check it out and see if there's organizations that offer things for veterans. I think you'd be pretty surprised to find out just how many there are in your area.
This is true.
Well, Aaron, it has been a pleasure speaking with you today, learning about your time in Iraq and, you know, the things that you've done and the journey that you've gone through writing your book and everything. Where can people go to get a copy of your book and to follow you and learn more about you and what you're doing?
You can follow me on Instagram. My name is Combat Dads with an S. I have my book, Bakuba Bones and Blood. It's out right now at Barnes & Noble. You can get it through Walmart. You can get it through anywhere books are sold. But I'm going to be doing a hardcover release, and that will be the spring of 2022. Because I just got a new editor on board. She's Sarah Perry, whose book she's going to be editing this book now, but she's busy. Okay. So it's going to be a few months. So I delayed the time it was going to be released, but she's on board now, and I couldn't be happier. Like,
oh, that's great.
When she said she was down for doing it, I was just like, I think I felt high for a day.
Like, yeah, I know that feeling when you get that good news. Like that goal that you wanted to have, that you get that rush, and it just feels good. And you know, so if for nothing else, write a book so you can get those kind of rushes. So you can have a sense of accomplishment, you know.
That's what it is too. I think you're just feeling accomplished immediately. It's like,
right,
your subconscious goes, oh my God, you did it.
Well, I'll have links to all of that, your social media, and links to get the book in the show notes. So anyone who's looking to get a copy of the book, go check out the show notes. You can click through there
and if anybody wants the book for free, I send free PDFs of it. So just DM me and I'll send you a free PDF so you can check it out, see if it's something that you want to buy.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's awesome. And if you do buy the book, leave reviews and help out Aaron. You know, those reviews are the way these sites, you know, whether it's Amazon or Barnes & Noble, you know, that's the way they recommend books to other people. So leave reviews if you've checked out that book. You know, give them some love with those reviews and help them out there. So again, Aaron, it's been a pleasure speaking with you, and I really do appreciate you taking the time to join us.
Same to you, sir.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube at Drive On Podcast.